I am really, really pleased to be here today. Any time I can get back to UVA, I do so. And I want to dedicate this little talk today to my parents, because they went along with my decision to go to UVA, even though it meant turning down Harvard and turning down a full ride at Northwestern. There was just something about the University of Virginia that made me want to be a part of it. And I think, in retrospect, it had to do with Jefferson watching over us, although it took me a while to learn that. One of the things I've learned as a lawyer is that one of the essential skills that's often underrated is storytelling, because people really understand their world by telling stories about what's happened or what's going to happen. And everybody who's ever approached a jury certainly knows that, but it's also true of citizens who are going to lobby the government or anybody who's working in any legal context. The facts are much more powerful if they can be woven into a story that helps people make sense of it. So I'm going to do this in the form of three intermingled short stories. And the titles, I guess, my working titles, and I should say, I had prepared remarks, which I threw out last night, not uncommon. And so I have no written speech, just some notes about what I want to talk to you about. And I think it will actually work better that way. But so my three working short stories, the three working titles are The Transition. That's necessary because when I was a student at Virginia, if a conference like this had been held, I definitely wouldn't have been here. I didn't take anything related to public service law. I took, I was headed towards corporate tax law, and so you might well wonder how I got where I am. So we'll talk a little about that. The second one is called "Aha! International Shoe is Relevant." This was a shocking revelation to me. But that chapter will include the beginnings of the impact of the Jeffersonian principles on my work as a legislator. And then the third chapter, the third little story, I will tentatively call The Ghost in the Machine. And that's the story about getting into the mechanics of democracy and elections and voting machines. One of the most interesting things that I've had the opportunity to get into. And then I will leave time for questions, because that's usually the most fun part of the whole thing. So how did I get here? Well, this is the part where I had to write some of it down, because I'll forget. I started out, as I said, and I wouldn't have been at a conference like this, because I was thinking, well, maybe I would be in-house counsel to a small privately held corporation, so I should know a little bit about all the kinds of things that you would have to do. And how did I get to law school? I actually fell in love with the Uniform Commercial Code in a business law class. Now, this probably sounds sick to most people, but the UCC is really a thing of beauty. I mean, it is structured to make commercial transactions work, make them understandable. Regular people who don't have a law degree, I think, will find that the things that they would expect to be true of contracts and commercial transactions actually are codified in the Uniform Commercial Code. So it facilitates our expectations of how commerce should work in a way that just saves all kinds of misunderstandings. And the whole idea that the law would provide some mechanism like this was quite novel to me. And it really is what got me to law school, because I think I was headed probably to graduate school in mass communications and organizational communications, which was a field that was just beginning to look at things like how television and radio and mass media would affect our world. Of course, nobody at that point was thinking about Facebook and Twitter, but that's a field that certainly has changed dramatically. And I'm grateful for that background, too. So I started out at Hughes, Hubbard & Reed on Wall Street, and I negotiated a month in the L.A. office because I really couldn't decide whether I wanted to clerk on Wall Street or in L.A. And I grew up in Northern Illinois, so I'd never spent any time in either. And one of the experiences I had as a summer clerk was a document production for a Fortune 50 company in Corpus Christi, Texas. It was an antitrust case. There were, I don't know how many senior partners, junior partners, wet behind the ear associates, and all of us sat side by side in dusty warehouses going through box after box of documents in response to a subpoena that spelled out a number of categories of documents that the U.S. government was interested in this antitrust case. You spend 16 hours a day looking at documents. You really start to get punchy. And I will really never forget the day that I spent in the office supply ordering files, boxes. And I learned exciting things, like the increase in the hot chocolate orders in February could probably be attributable to the colder weather. We had, I believe, 22 Kelly girls, and they were girls. They were Kelly girls supporting all of this as we notated the pages that had to be photocopied and produced. And the Kelly girls went off with some gigantic copying machines and made copies of all this stuff. And then some paralegal with a document stamper stamped every page and logged what it was. And at that moment, I realized that I was not interested in doing large-scale litigation. I simply could not imagine spending all of that time doing document production at that level. Now, that perspective changes, and I'll talk about it in Chapter 2, during the California energy crisis, during a document production that was aimed at Enron, which had some very interesting twists and turns to it. But at that point, I thought, that's it. There's no way I'm going to do large litigation. I thought there has to be a better way of solving problems like this without that kind of document production. I think my view now is there probably isn't. When you look at cases like the tobacco cases, which a friend of mine litigated, the priest abuse, the clergy abuse cases. I served in the state Senate with one of the counsel on those cases. And, you know, a case that took many years to crack, the very first one, but just changed the whole world we live in completely. So that was the point where I really began to have some respect for what happened with trial lawyers. But anyway, for family reasons, I went to Chicago, to Winston and Strawn, after I graduated from Virginia. And I, as a junior associate, I was assigned to do ERISA law, pension law, as well as some tax law. And while I would not say that ERISA law isn't fascinating, I did observe that you almost never had emergencies if you were doing pension law. And in fact, the partner who was the head of that section was fondly nicknamed Day Train Lane because he made the 5 o'clock train back to the suburbs every day. And I concluded that you could actually make a very good living doing pension law, but what you traded it for was being pretty bored most of the time, because there's just not really all that much on a day-to-day basis that's all that exciting about it. Although there were some interesting matters, and I once worked on an ERISA exemption from something that we called the Hey Hey Frito-Lay exemption. It's probably in the code. You can guess who the client was. So Eventually, I went back to Los Angeles from Chicago and spent a few years doing corporate tax and securities law, which I thought was more interesting because I got a chance to be part of startup businesses and really look at how things start. And in California, we start some pretty interesting things. It was, early on in our tech revolution, but still, I began to see the beginning of it. Still, what happened was during a period of recession, the main California partner who had all of the clientele for the startups got tired of being an arm of a Wall Street office. He felt like he didn't get no respect. And so he took his entire portfolio and went to another law firm, leaving, I think, 15, 16 associates with really not much to do. And eventually, the firm just discarded that part of its business. And at that point, I thought I might never practice law again. I worked on starting a toy company. I did a variety of things, and then one day somebody asked me if I could do some work on the startup of a country and western music magazine. And I looked at my checkbook and my bank balance, and I said, yeah, I could do that. And so that was the beginning of my going back to practicing law again, but really on my own terms, which was very different than what I had done in a large law firm. I had complete control over what I worked on. If there was something that I thought was close to the edge, I didn't do it. I no longer was in the situation where I was advising a client about whether its errors in admissions policy would cover certain actions that it might take with regard to its pension plan, i.e. terminating the plan, creating an actuarial surplus by amending the plan to minimum benefits, terminating the plan, and then taking back that actuarial surplus into the corporate coffers. The employees, as you might guess, objected to that scheme, promptly brought suit and won, and eventually all of that legal work we did to amend and terminate the plans was for naught, as the employees were able to get back their pension money. But that was really the point when I thought, okay, I have to have control of what I'm going to do because I don't like how I feel when I'm working on something like that. So I started practicing law, but I also then joined Neighborhood Watch. And from Neighborhood Watch, I started to work with a little nonprofit, and it really was small, called Heal the Bay. I think that it didn't have a permanent office yet. We were meeting in somebody's dining room. I think there were one or two paid employees. But we were trying to teach people that things that go into the storm drain actually go directly into the ocean, which is counterintuitive. And when we would do focus groups on that, there were about 5% of Angelenos who knew that, and the other 95% would ridicule them and say, but that's ridiculous. Nobody would design a sewage system or a stormwater system that would do that. And so we had some work to do. It eventually turned into a model storm drain ordinance, which I helped write, and a major stenciling program. And I think you see that kind of stenciling across the country now, any place where there's a watershed that goes into an ocean or rivers. So that was a lot of fun. And I quickly discovered that if you had a law degree and you were willing to volunteer your time, you could stay really busy, but you still had to pay bills. So I sort of had my own little scheme of doing public interest law, which was to have some major business clients who paid the typical billing rate at the time, and then other clients who basically paid nothing, or where perhaps I might get fees down the road, having been part of a public interest case. But that was really what took me off into a different direction and what eventually led to my decision to run for office. And I really was just too naive to know that you couldn't just run for a seat in the state legislature and win. So I ran as a Democrat in a seat that was supposed to be a safe Republican seat. And as luck would have it, it was 92, it was the year of the woman. And it was, I think my name, Venice Liberal Lawyer, I was called in all of the campaign material. I really thought that was my first name by the end of that campaign. And it was a shocking campaign because I remember on my birthday, at the end of October that year, waking up to find a piece of campaign mail that compared me to a Nazi and a brown-shirted fascist. And the last time I'd been in an election actually was at UVA in 1976 when I ran for student council. And somebody drew a mustache on my campaign poster, and I was so humiliated that it took me, 15 years or something to get up the courage to run again. But being called a Nazi was a lot worse than that. And when I called my campaign consultant, he laughed and said, that's really funny. And indeed, there was a backlash. And it was fascinating to watch. And it was part of the experience of developing thick skin, which I think is really critical to doing public law or to being a judge. I know my friend Jennifer Bruner, who's the Secretary of State of Ohio and shared the JFK Award with me, told me that she was prepared to be the Secretary of State because as a judge, you angered at least half the people who came in front of you. At least half of everyone who came in front of you was unhappy with your decision. Sometimes everyone was unhappy if you got moved towards some kind of compromise. So I was, I think, more or less prepared for what I got into. And that's how it happened. It complete accident. But I think speaks very strongly to the power of just following what your interests are and doing something that interests you. I think that roads into a career path come up when you do that that you just wouldn't see if you had it all mapped out. I was never one of those people who mapped out, though, you know, all of the steps that it would take me to become a partner in my big law firm. That just seemed like way too much of a commitment. Although the managing partner at Winston & Strawn right now is the guy who I started with in 1979 as two of the three tax associates. So, you know, we've had a good laugh. Okay, so he's running the firm and I'm running elections and a whole lot of other things. I think I got the better end of it, but he certainly has a nicer car than I do. And that's certainly one of the things you have to contend with in public service. When I started in the legislature making a salary of $52,500 a year, that was actually a pay increase for me because I had been doing so much public service work. I think I may have been the only lawyer ever elected to the legislature who got a pay increase when taking office. But that first year was really the beginning of the chapter where I learned the relevance of international shoe and start to really live the Jeffersonian principles, and in particular, transparency and open government. When I got there, I discovered that we had all of the information about bills, voting records, analysis. Everything was digital. It was all on the computer. But you couldn't have access to it from outside the Capitol unless you were willing to pay either a couple of hundred dollars a month or $1,200 a year for a subscription to a private provider who took that feed, that free feed, and then resold it to the citizens whose tax dollars had created it. And that just didn't seem like the way things should be to me, and I was aware that there had been a dial-up bulletin board system for planning commission agendas in the city of Santa Monica. And I introduced that as a bill. A couple of guys from Silicon Valley came into my office and said, no, you need to amend this to say that this information is going to go out over the world's largest non-proprietary computer network, which is the internet. And so they did that. And that bill was a really difficult thing to get passed. Never had a no vote. But there were lots of attempts to bury it and some fair amount of treachery. At one point, I discovered that the general counsel to the legislature was meeting with one of the two for-profit vendors without telling me. Now, in the private sector, I think that would get you disbarred. I'm pretty sure it would. But I was a new legislator. I had no idea what you would do in that kind of circumstance. So I went to a more senior legislator who said, well, go talk to the guy about it, which I did. And a couple weeks later, it happened again. I found out about it while the meeting was in process, and so I just walked into the Legislative Council's office and said to the receptionist, I'm here for the meeting about AB 1624. And I was, of course, admitted into the room. So that was the end of the secret meetings on that bill. But it was really fascinating. I got to see how you work the procedure, legislative procedure, and how important it is to know the rules. And I had a lot of trouble getting the powers that be to set that bill for a hearing. Once it got set, I could always get a unanimous vote, but getting it set was another matter. And then I had to contend with a hostile amendment in the Senate that put a provision into the bill that would have allowed the legislature to charge for this access, which was completely counter to what it was all about. And it was the first time that I had to deal with a serious conflict between my ultimate goal and what compromises I might have to make. And I had to consider that compromise. And I watched that going on every day in the federal government, the state government, regulatory agencies. But I remember going home and sort of imagining Thomas Jefferson hawking the Constitution on the Home Shopping Channel. And I thought, you know, no, there's no place in the world that has this information available online right now. So what I do here is going to be very important because it's likely to be copied. And I decided that I would rather lose the bill than have that provision stay in it. So I stood my ground as a freshman legislator and got the powerful state Senate to take out the charge provision. And the bill ultimately was signed by then-Governor Pete Wilson on the very last day for signing bills. We had no idea whether it was going to be signed or not. We knew that the two private companies were lobbying very hard for a veto, and one did, in fact, go out of business almost immediately thereafter. How do you get people to pay for something that's now free? Well, part of the way you do that is you have better service. And we had a pretty clunky front end at the beginning that allowed access. But it got better over time, and we let people to subscribe to bills and get an e-notification when something was going to happen. And it really piqued my interest in technology and the law. So if I'd been going to take a class in law school that would have led me to do, that would have helped in much of what I've done, it would have been a class that couldn't have existed because the internet in the way we know it now, none of it existed. And if you wanted to take a technology class, really I think the only thing you might have thought about would have been patent law, which wasn't what I was after at all. I was much more interested and have stayed interested in how technological advances affect society and what it means for the law. What do you do if you have a wiretapping statute that's written in such a way that you have to physically tap a wire? And it's written that way because you can't criminalize something unless you have it very specifically described. Now you have cordless phones and a wireless network. All of a sudden, your eavesdropping statute, your wiretapping statute, doesn't apply. So you start to ask, is there a way to write the law so that it encompasses the changes that are likely to occur? Sometimes the answer is yes, sometimes it's no. I remember as a private practitioner dealing with the same issue in the context of artists' rights when movies went from the big screen to videotape. And simply nobody had anticipated that in all of the contracts that provided for royalties. And of course the movie studios provision was that anything that's not specified, we don't owe you any money for selling, and that was not the provision of the directors, the writers, and so forth, and but there was no statutory framework for that. So it really, though, was the beginning of what led me into what ultimately led to the electronic voting machine controversy. And the next thing that happened was actually the courts asked me to serve on a court technology task force. And that's where I really got the education in technology, not through the legislature, but through a court task force that sent us to the Kennedy School for a few days, and we went around and looked at what was going on in various states on court automation. Because many states at the time, and I think some are still this way, if you wanted to transfer a case from one court to another, you literally took the paper file and sent it over to the other court, and somebody had to type in all of the information again. If you wanted information in a criminal proceeding on somebody's driver's license or driving record, the DMV had to produce that on paper and send it over to the court. There was no way that records could simply be exchanged electronically. So there was a lot of room for making government work better and less expensive and avoiding the mistakes that you get in transcription, which is one of the keys. We also hadn't had the discussions that were forthcoming on what happens to privacy and security in an age where so much is electronic. And those privacy and security discussions, which began with the bill to put the legislature online, really are at the forefront of a lot of what's going on now. If you look at all of the health proposals, you'll see that one of the fundamentals is getting medical records available any place, anywhere, so that you don't do tests over again that have already been done, or you don't miss some key piece of information. But that means having all of that online somewhere, and then you start immediately into questions of privacy and concerns about security. So those two issues, I think, are all pervasive now in our society, and we still really haven't solved them. Instead, what happens is the bad guys are getting far more creative at identity theft and other such things, and the government regulatory agencies that are supposed to be looking out for us are never going to have the money to hire the very best computer science students or the lawyers who know the very most about the technology. So we're going to have an ongoing tension. I saw that in the international shoe phase of my career. And that started when I began to deal with the thorny issue of spam. At that point, spam filters really didn't exist, and probably 80% of what was coming into most people's email boxes was, at the very least, objectionable. Images were coming in. There was a good likelihood that if your 14-year-old had an email account, that the images were coming in were not things that you as a parent would really appreciate coming in to that email account. So I began to deal with the question of spam. And as a state legislator, of course, all I have are state laws to do it with. And immediately we run into minimum contacts. I remember the day that we were looking at what we were doing. We were getting information back from legislative counsel, who was no longer meeting with opponents to my bills without telling me. And I had a eureka moment. Like, oh my God, international shoe. That's what's going to run the show here. And it is in so many things, and particularly when it comes to technology, where you basically have, you know, the electrons are and the wires and the waves are everywhere, and the question is, who has jurisdiction? Whatever scheme you come up with that's in the public interest to handle the security and the privacy concerns, who gets to enforce it, and under what circumstances? So I began to see that some of the classes I'd taken in law school were actually relevant to what I wanted to do in public interest. That happened again excuse me, during the energy crisis, the point when I was serving as the chair of the Energy Committee, when we started to have rolling blackouts in December, and ultimately my trial lawyer friend, who had been the counsel, one of the co-counsels in the priest abuse cases, called me one day and said, let's set up a select committee on energy, utilities, Senate Select Committee to investigate price manipulation of the wholesale energy market. And it was named that because for jurisdictional reasons, because the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has much of the jurisdiction over those matters, but the FERC was doing absolutely nothing, just kind of sitting back, watching us in California have blackouts. Eventually, I was part of an effort to get the FERC to take some action to control the market by basically telling them, look, people are going to die. People in nursing homes, people are going to die. And if FERC doesn't act, those deaths are going to be on your hands. And that ultimately was what got FERC to move. But in the meanwhile, we had this committee, nine people, mostly lawyers. Everything we did was bipartisan. And we pretty quickly ran into issues of discovery involving Enron. All of the other big energy companies gave us all the documents we asked for. We got documents from Duke, documents from Reliant, documents from the municipal utilities, and then there was Enron. And the situation was that there were cameras and reporters just crawling in the Capitol, and it wasn't just the LA Times or the San Francisco Chronicle. It was the Wall Street Journal. It was the Economist. When we were dealing with major inputs to the world economy. And there we were, trying to get Enron to produce documents. And Enron refused to produce documents, so we began contempt proceedings. And contempt proceedings hadn't happened in the California legislature since 1932, in a case in which cement price fixing actually was taken to the investigation and the refusal of the companies to produce documents did go through contempt proceedings in the state Senate, and it ended up in jail time for executives of the cement companies. That was the only precedent. That was it in the entire history of the state of California. So there we were, threatening Ken Lay and others with jail time in California for refusing to turn over documents. And we'd get promises from Enron's counsel that documents would be forthcoming soon. Nothing would happen, so we would proceed another step. And one of the days that I will never forget in that discovery, and this was like so completely different to me than the Corpus Christi and the warehouses. I mean, we were looking for what is it that's happening in the energy market. We were pretty sure there was market manipulation going on. But you have to be able to prove it. You have to be able to prove it. And we couldn't. Eventually, Enron did agree to send us documents. And they avoided a contempt vote on the state Senate floor by one day. They let us get pretty serious about it. But still, when we did get the boxes of documents that we requested, one of the things that we got was a file box of used pizza boxes and dirty chili bowls and coffee cups. So even in its document production, Enron was making it pretty clear how they felt about the state of California poking around in their business. But ultimately, that committee discovered the recording of Enron's energy traders talking about sending electricity out of state where the FERC price caps didn't apply, and then changing the price and sending it back in state at about, many, many times what it had cost when it was generated in the state of California. So we learned about Fat Boy. We learned about Death Star. We learned about the various manipulative trading strategies that Enron used. And once again, we were confronted with a situation in which Enron had a workroom full of of smart guys with computers figuring out how to take advantage of the rules in such a way that it would be impossible for the regulators to see them. It reminds me greatly of what happened with the financial market meltdown, because there was no single regulator who could see the entirety of what was happening. The state could only see the transactions that were in California. We couldn't see what was happening out of state, much as various regulatory agencies only saw parts of what was happening. But it really led me to believe that you have to have a regulator who can see all the pieces for markets to work. My term in the Senate came to an end, and I was contemplating going back to the private sector. We have term limits in California. One day someone said to me, "Well, why don't you run for Secretary of State?" That was in about 2005, and we had just been through Ohio and Florida and a couple of elections that were greatly contested. And I thought, that's not a bad idea. And so off I went, running statewide, and basically promising people that I would do a top-to-bottom review of every voting system that we used in the state of California. And that meant taking all of those principles of transparency and accountability and applying them, but being very constrained, because that is all privately owned software. And so it all has intellectual property protection. And as a result, the only person in the entire state of California who had a legal right to look at the software and the voting systems was the Secretary of State. And anybody who was hired or designated by the Secretary of State who had to sign a confidentiality agreement. So we did that. We produced a major report. We did invite hackers to come in to try to defeat the system. And you heard a little bit of what it was like, but just the basics. You could open one of the manufacturer's voting machines with any standard file cabinet key or any hotel minibar key. They all were keyed the same. Now, you can understand why they're all keyed the same. We have about 24,000 polling places in California. Imagine what would happen if every polling place had a different key. How many people do you think would lose the key between when they got it and election day? So the keys were all standard. Now, one of the companies had a copy, they had an online store for parts for the voting machines. They had a copy of their key on it. Two Princeton computer science professors took that template to the key store, had a key made with it, and opened the voting machine with it. There were security seals, but that wasn't really a problem either, because it was a clamshell design and the security seals were here. But it was no problem to just remove two screws on the other side and open the machine the other way. You had complete access to the inside. You finish up, screw it back together again, and the security seal is fine. Doesn't look like anything happened. And we were sending this equipment in some California counties home with people to sit in their garages or cars or whatever for sometimes up to 2 weeks before an election, all ready to go. Just turn it on and, you could start voting. So we really didn't meet the standards. And the reason that it took us every minute we had to do the work is that I figured that there was a substantial likelihood that we would be sued. And I got back my UVA lawyer hat, and together with a very talented lawyer who heads up the voting technology division, a gentleman by the name of Lowell Finley, we worked through all of the conditions and all of the findings to try to make them bulletproof in litigation. 69 conditions. Ultimately, we were sued only over one. It had to do with post-election auditing, and we won that. So it was a place where the legal skills were critical. I think throughout my career as a legislator and as Secretary of State, that things, it just wouldn't have worked without the law degree. Having that background, already understanding principles like minimum contacts, knowing how the First Amendment might affect speech issues when it came to new technology, all of those kinds of things were, I think, imperative to my ability to deal with what were really emerging issues, because what I've had the pleasure of doing throughout all of this is, instead of just going and working on issues that that you're redoing, in the criminal code is the criminal code, and it's important that somebody look at it and that we get it right, but the issues aren't new. When you get to energy trading, or you get to how you handle spam, or what you do with wireless communication, or how you handle voting machines, you're basically dealing with issues that nobody has ever thought about before. When you start to put public records online, all of a sudden you have to think about privacy in a different way than you did when you just had paper records. So it's been, I think, it's just been a real privilege to be able to be at that kind of forefront and to have a strong interest in how the technology works. Because whatever you do in the public sector, you have to be really knowledgeable about the underlying subject matter area that you're working in. I think you always get called out if you don't know the facts and how things work. It's always a challenge that we have as lawyers. Yeah, we think about it in law school. You have the facts, and you have to apply the law to the facts. But it turns out to be really essential. And then the key with all the new stuff is to try to figure out, well, what should the standard be? How do we think about this? What do we do with somebody who's bullying on Facebook? How do you assign responsibility to a parent who sets up a Facebook account in order to harass somebody else's kid? Just always interesting new areas. And with the voting system stuff, I feel like I have the mechanics of democracy in my hands. The democracy doesn't work if people can't trust the system that they use to cast ballots. That's been made abundantly clear to all of us in the last couple of years in some international elections. But I think it's also true domestically, and the standards that we use to monitor international elections, we couldn't meet. So the Carter Center that does the monitoring of international elections would not monitor elections in the U.S. because we don't meet the standards that are set up. We don't have one consistent system. We don't have one set of rules. We have something like 1,700 election jurisdictions with all kinds of different rules, and that is cause to think about federalism and what it means for people, for example, the soldiers who I met in Iraq and Afghanistan. They've got a manual that has 500 pages of instructions on how to cast a ballot depending on where you live, all different time frames, and all of that's been states' rights. But at some point, you have to ask yourself, well, when does that collide with an individual right to vote? Then I realized that in the U.S. Constitution, there actually is no right to vote. It's not there. It is there in the California Constitution. And there are many things that are in the Constitution, but the right to vote is not one of them. It dates back to our history, to slavery, to Jim Crow laws, and there just isn't a right to vote in the U.S. Constitution. So somebody out there, some young lawyer who's thinking about public service, needs to pursue that, because we really ought to have that basic principle in our Constitution. It's taken us a long time to get the right to vote to where it is now. We don't take it for granted I look around this room and wonder how many would have met that standard of white male and own 50 acres of property, which was what it was required to vote in most states at the time that the University of Virginia was founded. But I do take the Jeffersonian principles very solemnly, and particularly the Jeffersonian idea that if you don't believe that people have adequate knowledge to make decisions, then the remedy is not to take the decision-making away from them, but to inform their discretion. That's the Jefferson terminology. I said that once on the assembly floor, and people were like, inform their discretion? Yeah, Thomas Jefferson said it. You know him, right? All of that is, I think, critical. It's been key to what has kept me interested in for so many years, and I never would have imagined that I would find a career that would keep me fascinated for close to 20 years now. There's always something new. There's always some problem that has gone unrecognized. And then they're just the really simple things, like solving a problem for somebody whose voter registration isn't right and it needs to be made right. And I always go to, well, what can we do in the system to prevent this? Do we have a way that people can check online? Can they look at what their signature's like on their voter registration card so that if they signed the card with a little star over the I in their name when they were 18, that now at age 60, they can maybe find a way to see if that signature still looks like their signature. So it's always, you know, looking for what can we do systematically? How can we set up the procedure so that we always have the kinds of checks and balances in democracy? And then how do we create transparency in the election system? And really the only way to do that is to move toward open source software, not to rely on proprietary software for elections. Whatever else you might think about it in any other context, I think when it comes to elections, we just simply have to have a system where every citizen can view the software that is setting up ballot design or tabulating results. I'm not worried about the fact that not everybody will be able to understand the software. The number of volunteers who've come forth to deal with voting system and voting system software would just blow your mind. And computer scientists are not known for their political activism. But they come forth, and if somebody finds a voting machine on eBay, which is how the analysis of the machines all started, somebody bought a machine on eBay and called up a professor at Johns Hopkins and said, hey, I got this voting machine. You're a computer science security guy. You want to take a look at it? And he said, sure. And they proceeded to take it apart and were shocked at what they found. So, you know, we're in a place that we didn't have to be. And as we move forward, we have to ask, well, how do we set things up so that we have the kind of transparency so that I'm not the only person in the state of California who has the legal right to review the software, because that's just crazy. So yeah, there's the law, but then we got to ask, first, will your grandma understand the principles? And second, you know, is it broad-based enough so that we have real accountability? And that's where I can continue to go as Secretary of State, just keep looking at how we can change the system so that it works better for people, so that it's easier to do. And then I continue to watch what's happening on the things I worked on in the legislature, and in those moments, I really miss it. Although with our multi-billion dollar budget deficit in California, I have to say being the Secretary of State's a pretty good gig right now. Probably a lot better than staying in the legislature. Oh, I forgot my slide. I was going to tell you at the start of that last chapter. Here's how I knew that we needed to take action on voting, on the voting systems. Now, I was pretty amazed to find that bumper sticker in Texas, not in California. A couple Texas activists gave it to me. But I often, when I'm talking about voting systems, I start with that slide, because regardless of what you think about the message, the fact that people feel that way about our electoral system in the United States of America tells us that we have work to do. We really need to make this bumper sticker be a kind of thing that people scratch their heads and say, I don't get it. And I think we're moving towards that, towards better transparency, and it's certainly different from state to state. I grew up in Illinois, so I know something about that. And I can teach you all how to hack a lever voting machine with a toothpick or a number two pencil. Save that for lunch. So that's it. That's the story. And I think the lesson is that it's really possible to take a UVA law degree and do just about anything with it. It doesn't matter so much what you took when you were here, because how you learn to think and the basics, even international shoe, will turn out to be important. And you can learn the specifics of just about any area of the law. And there will continue to be new ones as long as you have the basic principles down and you know how to analyze and think. So I'm looking forward to joining you for lunch and that conversation. And you all are a step ahead of where I was in law school. So you should consider yourselves fortunate when you start right out of law school in a public service career. You'll have that many more years to do that many more interesting things. And you can go in and out of the private sector, many people do, or find ways to do public interest law in the private sector. I've certainly had my share of doing that, too. So for me, it's been a fantastic thing to do with my UVA law degree, which hangs right inside the door to my office in Sacramento. It's billboard-sized, unlike some other law degrees. I want to make sure that nobody misses it. And I often refer to the experience of just soaking in Jefferson for 3 years. I think it's really hard to go to law school here and not come out with some pretty intense feeling about how miraculous the idea of self-governance is. I think many of us take it for granted, but we shouldn't. And it's not something that's instinctive, so we have to teach it. We have to teach it to the next generation of law students, and we have to teach it to the next generation of home care workers and the next generation of laborers, because we're all a part of it, and it only works if everybody makes their voice heard. So thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here, and it's great to be with people who have a commitment to public law and who I know are going to change the world.